From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Harvey continues to pound Texas, and Michigan's Red Cross is responding.
One of the things that we all in Michigan can be most proud is that we are always one of the first regions asked to deploy and come to everyone's aid. It's all hands on deck.
Michigan's long history with hate groups.
They gave cover to people who were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-black.
Sports commentator John Eubacon on Michigan's season opener against the Florida Gators.
A team that makes the fewest mistakes is going to win this one.
And Michigan State against Bowling Green.
Get back to blocking and tackling. That's what D'Antonio's teams do so well. They lost that last year.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. College football is kicking off its new season. Coming up later this hour, sports commentator John Eubacon stops by to look at just what's in store for the state's top programs this season. But first, Hurricane Harvey has been downgraded to a tropical storm, but Texas is not out of danger. Harvey continues to dump record-breaking amounts of rain on Houston and other Gulf Coast communities, and Michigan's Red Cross is reaching out to help. Kimberly Burton is the Regional Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross's Michigan region. And Kimberly, the images and the stories from Texas are absolutely overwhelming. So many people have lost everything. Many, many thousands have had to evacuate. How is Michigan's Red Cross responding?
Oh, you are so correct. Those images, unfortunately, don't even begin to tell the tale. We've had a chance to speak with some of our volunteers and colleagues that are down there, and they're telling us that it is absolutely horrific. But one of the things that we all in Michigan can be most proud is that we are always one of the first regions asked to deploy and come to everyone's aid. It's all hands on deck. And right now, we have deployed over 60 individuals, both colleagues, volunteers, executives, down to the Texas area. We also are in the process of sending down 8 emergency response vehicles. They're on their way down there. So our volunteers, our community partners, our colleagues, we have rallied the troop and we're doing whatever is necessary at this point.
And these over 60 folks deployed and heading to Texas, what will they be doing?
A myriad of things. It's very, very interesting. Most people, because of the pictures that you see, you envision our Red Cross workers, you know, on the ground, literally, the deep wader boots out in the flooded waters, and we're absolutely there. We're there in the search and rescue. We're there helping to muck up and clean up, and we're there providing the first aid when it's needed. But there are also other aspects to volunteering that are equally as important. We have right now almost 30 shelters that are opened in those areas. We're expecting across the nation to support 50 different shelters, and we are prepared to feed, house, provide blankets and comfort to over 50,000 people. So as you can imagine, those volunteers that are there working within the shelters, they are providing all of those resources. And also, what people don't realize, we are also deploying executives and administrators down there because we need as many hands on deck to deal with those community leaders, government officials, elected officials. And then, of course, none of this is possible without the monetary donations. So we've got our fundraisers across the nation on the phones asking for our communities to help to support us.
And it made me wonder, I know that Michiganders are a caring bunch and they want to respond. And for people who want to help the folks in Texas, is the Michigan Red Cross accepting donations that can be earmarked for Texas?
Oh, without questions. And there are several ways. The easiest one, obviously, is 1-800-RED-CROSS. Also, if you visit the website, redcross.org, those opportunities are willing and very, very accessible and easy to navigate. And then thirdly, to those individuals that like to text, you can text the word Harvey to 90999.
Besides monetary donations, what else can you use to help Texas?
And you know, it's really interesting. Because of the floodwaters being so high, we have actually had to bring in our volunteers directly to those sites in what we call high-profile vehicles. Now, that literally means vehicles that are high enough off the ground to get through the high waters. We've actually been bringing in volunteers in dump trucks, 18-wheelers. So what can people do? Obviously, volunteerism is huge right now. Please access any of those opportunities that I just mentioned for volunteerism. And if your company or if you have a network or you know that there are huge vehicles available in those areas, use your networks. Reach out to your families and friends. We're looking. We've got to get access to these various hardest-hit areas in Houston and up and in Louisiana. So there are lots of opportunities. Spreading the word. Just spread the word. You'd still be surprised how many people who are not regular news watchers or listening to the radio have no idea just how horrific this situation is.
Kimberly Burton, Regional CEO of the American Red Cross's Michigan region, with a great way for everyone in Michigan who's been watching what's happening in Texas to be able to reach out and help. Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Today, the state of Michigan started issuing real ID driver's licenses and state ID cards. They meet the 2005 federal real ID law. It created tougher standards for getting that driver's license. And starting in October 2020, you will not be allowed to board a plane for a domestic flight without either a passport or a real ID driver's license or state ID. And you'll need to take some extra steps to get the real ID. Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson is here with us now. Happy to have you on board to kind of get us all on the same page about the real ID.
Well, it's great to be here because I want to make sure people do know this was a bipartisan act on Congress, and all the president sent have supported it, and it really was created in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, and it was recommended from the 9/11 Commission. The law sets documents and security standards for production of driver's license and IDs that will be real ID compliant, which, you're right, starting October 1st, 2020, you will need special ID, even if you're just flying within the state or other states. So we're offering this to people so that they don't have to get a passport if they don't want to. I think it's very important for people to know that we do have this for no extra charge. If you'd like to get it right away, there's a $9 charge to get a new driver's license anytime. But when you come in, there's no extra charge. And without a real ID compliant card, Michigan residents will not be able to board domestic flights or enter federal facilities after October 1st, 2020, unless they carry a passport or another approved identity document.
Right. And this is not at all to do with whether or not you can drive your car in Michigan.
No, you can get the standard driver's license if you would like and not get a real ID compliant driver's license or state ID. And it will just have on there in big letters, not for federal identification. But you can continue to get a standard driver's license or state ID if you don't plan on using it for flying or entering federal facilities, or maybe you have a passport or some other ID that will allow you to do that.
So what do we need to know about what it's going to take to get a real ID compliant driver's license or state ID card?
Yes, well, we've been requiring the same identity document since 2008. You will need to bring in either a passport or any other approved document, which is your birth certificate that has a raised seal on it. It can't be a photocopy. So a certified birth certificate or another document proving legal presence in the United States. And if you've changed your name for whatever reason, you'll need to bring a linking document such as a marriage certificate or court order with you, too.
So no, you can't do this online. You've got to walk into a Secretary of State's office with these certified copies.
That's right. You must come into one of our 131 branch offices. But I am encouraging all others to use ExpressSOS.com to try to keep our line short and moving. If you don't need a picture, you can probably do it online at ExpressSOS.com. It's easy, simple, hop online, not in line for everyone else. And that will just help us move our lines quicker. They'll look a little different. There will be a white star that's encased like a star on a flag in a gold circle. And that means that you are real ID compliant on your driver's license. So it's simple, doesn't cost any more if you would like it. If you don't want it, that's fine too.
And this is for 18 and over, right? So the 16 and 17-year-olds on their learner's permits and the like, it doesn't apply to them at this point.
That's right. The federal government does not require children under 18 to provide identification when they're traveling with a companion within the United States, but the companion will need acceptable identification.
And let's just say you don't think you're going to fly, but an emergency could crop up and you don't have that card, you aren't flying.
Yes. If you have a special driver's license that we already produce and some people order it so they can go to Canada or Mexico, you're already real ID compliant too. So a military ID also is acceptable. But if you don't have one of those three and you need to fly someplace in the United States, you won't be able to without a real ID compliant, some kind of a ID, which was put in by the federal government quite some time ago. The whole country is going to that, and so it's really important for people to know they will not be allowed to board an aircraft if they do not have some kind of ID that has a higher standard or shows that little white star and a gold ring, which is already with the standards that we've been using since 2008.
Ruth Johnson, Michigan Secretary of State, thank you so much for your time. Great talking with you.
Cynthia, thank you. Getting the word out is really important. I don't want somebody to get stuck at the airport.
And we should remind you there is a lot of information on this Real ID law and the way we're rolling out these new driver's licenses and state ID cards on the website for the Michigan Secretary of State. Start at michigan.gov/realid and you'll get all the information you need. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time to say something that we have not been able to say for a few months. Let's talk some sports with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Nothing like some ferocious book deadlines to keep a guy on virtual house arrest chained to his laptop. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Two books in 1 year, probably not my best idea, but worked out very well. Playing Hurt is out with John Saunders, and coming up next is the Great Halifax Explosion, which you probably haven't heard about, but you will,
wow.
I hope, very soon. November
Welcome
7th.
Back to the land of the living.
The light is very bright here, yes.
And this is perfect timing with college football kicking off. So let's start with the big one happening this Saturday in Arlington, Texas, number 11 Michigan versus the 16th-ranked Florida Gators. And Michigan's got a pretty good tradition against the Gators going into this weekend's game, including the fact they beat them in the 2016 Citrus Bowl. So what are the tea
leaves?
And
they beat them in Lloyd Carr's last game, also Citrus Bowl, I believe.
There you go.
In 2008 would have been.
What are the tea leaves tell you to expect this weekend?
Wild, gunslinging, crazy game, because it's the first game. These are two top 20 teams. They're very talented, both got serious coaching staffs. It's like the Michigan-Notre Dame game in the 70s and 80s when they did not play anybody else first. That is a crucial distinction, because Bo said you always make the most progress during the year between the first and second game. Well, this is the first one, so you haven't made the progress yet. So you're going to see plenty of mistakes out there. The team that makes the fewest mistakes is going to win this one. Four gaffes versus six, by the way, four wins. So that's how it's going to break down.
Now, Harbaugh's been keeping things kind of close to the vest, getting this team ready. Are you hearing anything leaking out, like surprises maybe in the starters for Saturday's game?
No real surprises. Wilton Spate has all but been announced as the quarterback for the team, so he comes back for his second year at the helm. John O'Korn put some pressure on him and will be a close number two, I believe. But Spate knows what he's doing. You've got new receivers. Still, the offensive line is a question, but the defense at Michigan should be outstanding.
So how high should fans' expectations be for this 2017 edition of the Wolverines?
Should be or are.
There's an important distinction.
I think 10-2 is well within reach and maybe better, but you've got five big games. Florida is a wild card. Michigan State is always going to play you tough no matter what. Then you've got to play Wisconsin on the flip side, the other side of the division. That'll be a tough game. And, of course, Ohio State and Penn State's on the road. So there's five games. If you win three of those five, you've done pretty damn well.
All right. Well, let's go over to Michigan State hosting Bowling Green this Saturday and that 3-9 season. What does Coach D'Antonio and the team, what do they got to do to shake off the hangover from last year?
Stay out of trouble. It is that simple. He's earned a lot of credibility, as well he should have, at Michigan State with great seasons, a phenomenal coaching job for a decade now at Michigan State, taking 2- and 3-star players, turning them into Big Ten titleists. It's a pretty amazing job. Off the field last year was a nightmare. I mean, all kinds of cases now underway, sexual assault, the worst things you can imagine pretty much. But he's got also Mark Hollis's AD, came out very strongly in his favor, handled the situation, I thought, very appropriately, as you and I have discussed, that he said, look, not lawyers, not PR men. Michigan State's my home. Your home has to be safe. Let's focus on that. So I think my theory is that D'Antonio's got all the rope in the world except for off the field. Nothing more off the field. With on the field, if you go 6-6, that's just fine. He'll get time to build it again.
I guess knowing that we've seen the normal attrition of players graduating, and certainly some have left the program under a cloud for disciplinary reasons, what do you think, given all that, is a reasonable expectation for Spartan fans going into this new season? I mean, you're saying 6-6, but what about the overall vibe?
The overall vibe is get back to blocking and tackling. That's what D'Antonio's teams do so well. They're not fancy. They're not flashy. They are fundamentally sound teams. They lost that last year. If you can show Michigan State fans, who are not dumb fans, if you can show them honest blocking and tackling, they'll recognize it, and they'll understand that you're not going to beat probably Ohio State this year. You might not beat Penn State this year, but you should give some of those teams a real run and be in most of the games and certainly knock off the Bowling Greens of the world.
Got to ask you about the Broncos. After last year's great season, you had great players. You had Coach Jeff Fleck. Some of the players are gone, and of course, so is Coach Fleck. So this Saturday night, Western Michigan's facing number 4 ranked USC in California. I'm seeing you just go, you're wincing.
This is a porcupine and a balloon. This is not going to go well. They lost a ton of talent from last year's team. The recruits they had coming in, Fleck took with him to Minnesota, which is at least a shade of gray. It's not illegal, but it's frowned upon, and certainly in the volumes that he did it.
There's kind of an aroma around all of that.
Yeah, it burns a bridge, essentially.
Yeah.
And he did a great job at Western, so I guess, fair enough. But Western Michigan's not got a lot going on. A new coach in Tim Lester. They won't be a bad team this year, but it won't be rowing the boat. Sorry.
No, rowing the boat.
And USC, cash the check, get on the bus, and go home.
Eastern had a strong season last year, made it to the Popeyes Bahamas Bowl, their first bowl invitation since 1987. We know they lost to Old Dominion, but, they made it to a bowl game. Do you still maintain the school can't afford a Division I football team?
Yes, and here's the horrible thing. Look, hats off to Chris Creighton. The head coach did a phenomenal job. Heather Likes, the longtime AD there, did a great job. She's now at Pitt. So hats off. It can be done there. But the exception proves the rule that even with that season, the stands did not fill up overnight. The enthusiasm is not great. The costs have gone up, not down. And again, 10% of the undergraduate tuition goes towards athletics. So we've got people here at Michigan Radio whose kids go there, of course. Great school. So of your $10,000 in-state, $1,000 goes to athletics. I don't know how that can be justified.
This Thursday night, Central Michigan will host the Rhode Island Rams. You had 15 starters returning, but quarterback is a big question mark following the departure of Cooper Rush. We don't get to say Cooper Rush, our favorite name anymore.
We'll have to find a way to squeeze that in each and every week, Cindy.
Cooper Rush. So what do the Chips need to do to make it to a third straight bowl game?
Stick back to their fundamentals. They've done a good job for the last 5 years, made it to a bowl game. They're winning 6 or 7 games per year, pretty much, which is not, Sterling numbers, not Western Michigan numbers, but it's a solid program. When you're in the MAC these days, you've played 12 games, of course. 4 of them are out of conference. And those 4 are going to be teams almost always who are going to beat you. So you have to win 6 out of the next 8 just to be .500. That's the challenge now in the MAC programs.
Final seconds we have over to the pros. Lions had their third preseason game Friday night, lost to the Patriots and Tom Brady. 30-28. It wasn't a massacre. Are you encouraged by anything you've seen so far in the preseason?
Nope.
Oh, wow. That was fast.
Thank you. We're busy professionals. Jim Caldwell's a very nice guy. The players love him, the head coach. The family I know, the Ford family, whom I think the world of, they love him too. But he's not a top 5 or top 10 coach. He looks like a deer in headlights. He's not calling plays. It's kind of the Brady Hoke system, basically, and this does not work at that level.
I will watch that. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
You've probably heard of and seen the free little libraries, those little boxes or tiny houses that hold books for neighbors to borrow and contribute. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea has taken that concept and turned it into a special way to offer assistance to folks in need of life's basic necessities, especially women. It's a box called E-Squared, Empathy and Equity. Adriana Flores has chosen a low-income housing complex called Edgewood Village for this new idea in Meridian Township, not too far from the Michigan State University campus. Adriana, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So this has been described as akin to a free little library. Would you describe the box and what's in it?
Sure. So it is a kind of like the same concept as a little free library, but instead of storing books, there's hygiene products. So there was someone who posted, because it always starts with Facebook, right, a post about somebody who took this concept in Arkansas and made a little free pantry. And I thought that was such a cool idea, but I thought that there was a different need that needed to be met here in Michigan. So I did research, and I found out that people who qualify for governmental assistance, hygiene products are actually excluded from what you can purchase. And so I figured, why not put up a box that would have those kind of items? So they're hygiene products, anything from soap, shampoo, conditioner, to pads, tampons. The hope is to help anyone who's in need of those products.
And tell us about where you chose to put this box.
I was discussing the topic with a couple of different organizations, and I talked to Helping Women Period, who's, oh my gosh, they're an amazing organization located here in Michigan, and they offer feminine hygiene products. So I was talking to one of the founders, and she told me, you know, why not maybe a Head Start or somewhere near a Head Start? So there was one that I tried contacting, and I walked up, and they didn't open their door, and I looked to my right, and it was the Edgewood Village Town Center, or Network Center, sorry, that was located right next to it. And I'd never really seen it before, although I live so close. And I'm like, you know what? Why not? I'm going to chit-chat with them and see what they think. So I walked over. I introduced myself, described the concept to them, and I met with community members, got their input, their thought, and it ended up just working out really nicely there.
Now, you just got your master's degree in social work from Michigan State, and I know you've done some studying in looking into how women make do when they can't afford these personal hygiene products. How do they compensate when they're menstruating?
You know, for people who are maybe homeless, there aren't really a lot of options. I mean, you do with whatever you can, getting maybe toilet paper from stalls. There's not a lot of options. So one of the things that really spoke to me and really hit me was the fact that there's this isolation that comes with not having those feminine hygiene products that you need. So not necessarily going out in public as much. And so you make do with what you can. So I thought that that was a position that nobody should have to be in.
What are the advantages, Adriana, of having like this neighborhood cupboard over, for example, having to go to a pantry or go somewhere to request and get these items?
Well, the anonymity is something that can be really nice. So it's actually located right next to their mailboxes. So as they're going to get their mail, they can stop and just check what's in the box or, you know, when they're leaving. So there's this sense of anonymity that goes with it, to just quickly grab something and leave and not have to stand in the line, explain yourself. And it's giving that sense of pride back, you know, of someone cares, someone's helping me, and I can quickly grab it and go, and this will help me until the next paycheck comes or, you know, the next thing that they need comes.
How are you keeping the E-Squared box stocked?
I contacted Helping Women Period, who is helping stock it with a lot of feminine hygiene products, which is amazing. They've already stocked it a couple of times. And then I've contacted a club at MSU, one that I was a part of, to make it a permanent service project. And officers last year were excited to have that happen. And then anybody who wants to help out, anybody who maybe happens to purchase one of those travel size soaps or something at Meijer that's only a dollar and wants to go put it in the box just to help someone out. And the organization that exists right in Edgewood Village has some relationships already built and receives products too. And so that's something that they can take outside and fill the box with as well.
Adriana, is the empathy and equity box, is this something you'd like to take through the Lansing area or even beyond?
Oh my gosh, I would love to see it spread. It would be incredible to see this idea resonate with other people and wanting to take it on and bring it to other people. The whole thought behind it was just to give people support and make other people know that they're not alone and they're okay. And so other people feel like that's incredible and want to bring that to their area. I can't even express how cool it would be to see this as kind of a movement that starts to happen.
With that in mind, is there a website where someone can, who's listening to us talk and thinks, you know what, I want to do this in my community. Is there a website they can go to?
Yes. So if you go to esquaredbox.weebly.com, that'll take you there. And there's a contact, so you can email me if you would like for more information, or check out the Facebook page if you want to kind of keep yourself up to date with those existing, or there's other ones people want to put up. I'd be more than happy to put it on there as well.
Adriana Flores. We want to thank you so much for your great idea and for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Zilka Joseph writes vivid, eloquent poems from a world of dual cultures, India, where she was born, and the Midwest, where she now makes her home. Joseph teaches creative writing in Ann Arbor and is an independent editor and manuscript coach. Her newest book of poems is titled Sharp Blue Search of Flame. As part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark, writer John Freeman has this review.
The poems in Zilka Joseph's second book, Sharp Blue Search of Flame, sear with poignant images and brilliant diction. Whether she's reinventing myths from Jewish and Hindu Indian culture or commenting on the contemporary American scene, this poet speaks with the authority of lived wisdom. The range of experience she captures spans from physical pain to erotic joy. Though troubling, even terrifying at times, this world we inhabit still holds great beauty, Joseph insists. On a technical level, Joseph executes stringent poetic forms as deftly as she does free verse. One of the book's most stunning poems, Mudras, Language of Hands, begins with a 20-line palindrome, a poem that reads the same backwards and forwards, before moving into subsequent sections of free verse. The staggered couplets and monostiches, single-line stanzas, flicker across the page in homage to the traditional Indian dance from which the poem draws its name. Mudras ends with the lines, "My three eyes of lightning strike the earth, the drummer drums in my skin, the dance begins again," offering the reader a glimpse of the joy the poet salvages in a deeply flawed world. The book also features a concrete poem and a contrapuntal, a poem featuring two voices that can be read together or separately. Few contemporary American poets utilize these forms with such clear-eyed purpose. Although Joseph writes about locales as disparate as Michigan and Dharamsala, the tacit threat of violence, specifically violence toward women, is ever present, regardless of setting. Joseph's critique of patriarchal control manifests most pointedly in the ways she reconfigures common Eastern and Western myths. When she writes of the Genesis creation myth, quote, "She, Eve, knew she would always be the sun, even when the gates closed behind her. And though history would try new tricks, twist orange to apple, the men with missing bones, the snakes, would stay the same," unquote. The reader feels the poem burst into sharp blue flame, scorching the story that has so maimed the Judeo-Christian conception of gender. Joseph also achieves moments of tenderness, especially in the tour de force, Rabia, in mourning. Not since Larry Levis, the late 20th century poet whose book Elegy revolutionized the poem of mourning, has America seen a poet tackle the elegy with such empathy and grace. "Walk slowly, Rabia, to the glass doors of the battered hearse, whose driver is an old Sikh man dressed in white, whose eyes are quiet. Walk slowly up to her whom you love. Sing your duas. Say Khoda Fez. She will hear you. She will thank you. Touch the top of your head and say, don't cry. But you will weep a river, and so will I." For Zilka Joseph knows how quickly the peril and the beauty of this world can break us.
John Freeman publishes poetry under the name Cal Freeman. He's author of the book Brother of Leaving and the chapbook Heard Among the Windbreak. You'll find his reviews and others at MichiganRadio.org. Supports for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, some carried shields and a flag with a slightly modified Detroit Red Wings logo. It's believed they were part of a group that calls itself the Detroit Right Wings. And that got us thinking about Michigan and its history with extremist groups. It bears examining when you consider that the number of violent attacks in this country inspired by far-right extremist ideologies has risen to more than 300 a year. That's according to a study done by West Point. Here with us is historian Joellen Vineyard from Eastern Michigan University. She's the author of Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. When did we first see right-wing extremism come to Michigan, and in what form?
Well, the most recent form of the militia came to attention in 1994 when they saw men in camouflage marching and training. And then the Free Press and other areas picked it up and said, well, what's going on in Michigan? It's a cauldron of hate. It's always been a place of hateful right-wing extremists. So that's what prompted this book.
So we go back then.
We go back.
Decades.
Really way back even into the 19th century when farmers tore up railroad lines and Detroiters, some of them tore up the railroad lines because the railroad was coming through their neighborhoods or scaring the cows. And so there's been this sort of citizen participation and, you know, let's take charge. But the 20th century, the first real group that emerges is the Ku Klux Klan. And it's a reborn Klan, not like the Reconstruction Klan, not like the one that came more recently.
In the 60s. But when we talk, are we talking about the fact that the Great Migration
That's
brought
right.
black workers right. up from the South?
Exactly.
Looking for auto jobs.
That's right. That was the time when there were, in 1920, somebody estimated 1,000 blacks were arriving in Detroit every week. So the population was undergoing great upheaval, along with World War I that had just ended. And so that helps explain it. The economy was really struggling.
And how much of a foothold did the KKK get?
The KKK had more members in Michigan than in any state in the South in the 20s. It was a big group. And it wasn't just Michigan. Indiana had an even larger group and the head of the National Klan. Michigan probably, it's so hard to get a figure exactly, but I would guess that one out of every 10 people eligible to belong to the Klan, which meant you really had to be white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, probably one out of 10 belonged. If you take into account women who also formed their own group, and they had a group for children.
When we think of Klan activities in Michigan in the 20s, what did that look like? Because certainly people have that Reconstruction era Southern idea of them riding in on horseback. But what was going on in Michigan?
They rode in Model Ts. That was on their card when they applied for membership. It said, do you have a car and how many people will it seat? Because they needed cars to take people to rallies. So the automobile made it possible for them to organize in groups, and they would gather in farm areas right south Oakland County outside of Detroit, but across the state. They were spread throughout the state. It was not just a local urban phenomenon.
And what kind of crimes?
They burned crosses. That was the most visible. That was the first sign that they were in the neighborhood and organizing. They burned crosses on the highest hill. They boycotted Jewish Catholic businesses. There was not a lot of, you know, outlandish evil killing here like there was in the South.
The lynchings.
Right. The lynchings, we have a very few. Some might have gone unreported. But more than that, they were protesters and they saw themselves as American patriots. That's one of the key things.
You mentioned they kind of waned and then rose again in the 60s, which I guess we need to address the fact that there was Pastor Bob Miles of Howell,
right,
who died 25 years ago this month. But he was what, Grand Dragon of the Michigan Ku Klux Klan?
He was. He's the one who was involved in the Pontiac bus bombing. At the time when judge ruled that Pontiac schools were segregated and they were going to have to bus students within, and then it moved on to cross-district busing as the next phase. But Miles was one with a group of friends who bombed the Pontiac buses in 1971. And he also was involved with his group in tarring and feathering the principal at Willow Run High School, who was trying to peacefully integrate the high school. He was a white man, and he was trying to peacefully integrate the high school, and they grabbed him, tarred and feathered him. And for the bombing and the tar and feathering, Miles went to prison for, I think, 7 years.
And even though he died 25 years ago, does his reputation and the fact that he was the Grand Dragon of the Michigan Klan, does that still hang over Howell?
It does. Howell has fought to get free from that, and it's not fair to label all of Howell as, you know, people involved in his version of the Klan. But their efforts so far, you know, have not worked out. That's all people remember about Howell.
I'm speaking with historian Joellen Vineyard, the author of Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. When the Klan in the 20s was burning crosses, one cross they burned was at 12 Mile Road in Woodward in Royal Oak in Oakland County. And that's when a Catholic priest named Father Charles Coughlin was setting up his new parish, the Shrine of the Little Flower. Anyone who drives by that corner sees that enormous church and that enormous stone crucifix that towers over that northeast corner of 12 Mile and Woodward, because Father Coughlin said, I'm going to build a cross that can never burn down. However, this is the priest who had a huge national radio audience throughout the Depression. Some call him the founder of hate radio. Let's take a quick listen to Father Coughlin in full-throated action before a cheering crowd.
We are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it.
So, tell us about Father Coughlin's radio program, which was listened to in homes across America during the Depression.
It had the biggest radio following of any program proportionally then or now. The Klan came in the Model T that powered them, and the radio was just new when Father Coughlin came to Detroit. And he struck up a friendship with someone in the radio world, and they decided initially he was going to broadcast catechism lessons, Bible stories for children. And then it morphed on, and it grew bigger after the Depression hit. He started at 26, 27, he's starting. When the Depression hit in Michigan by 29, and actually it hit here earlier than elsewhere, he then started to segue into economic issues and part of social justice issues. He was, in the outset, he was a major force for social justice. He believed that people should not be accumulating these vast amounts of wealth while others had none. And he really had a very advanced version of what the government should do, which is what brought him to the attention of Franklin Roosevelt. Coughlin was a good friend, first of Frank Murphy. And at that time, Murphy had been in various political positions, and Murphy knew Roosevelt. So that was the connection between Coughlin and Roosevelt. But Roosevelt saw that Coughlin had a big audience, a Catholic audience, that would serve him well in the elections. So Coughlin went to the convention in Chicago in 32, and he gave a speech. He was a very important cog in Roosevelt's whole operation. And then he didn't think Roosevelt moved fast enough. And so his sermons and his statements on radio started to get more and more harsh. And as that happened, of course, Roosevelt got more and more angry. First, he'd been calling the New Deal was Christ's deal. Then, within a while, he's saying the New Deal is the devil's deal. So then there was a rupture. And besides, Roosevelt didn't need him anymore. By 36, he didn't need Coughlin because he had that solid base.
So how did it evolve where there's this impression that Father Coughlin was against Jews and friendly to Hitler?
He was.
Yeah. How did that morph? So it's not just an impression.
It's not just a myth. The thing he was above all was Christian. And that explains his anti-Jewish attitudes and his support for Hitler. Besides that, he was against communism as the mortal enemy of Christianity and Catholicism. And he saw Hitler as standing as a bulwark against Russia. Communist Russia was his real nemesis.
So if awful things happened to Jews in Germany, oh well.
That's right.
Wow. I want to play the beginning of one of Father Coughlin's weekly radio addresses from 1938, and listen to the 1938 version of complaining about fake news.
We present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Good afternoon, my friends. Following last Sunday's broadcast, a vicious campaign of misrepresentation, based upon fancy and not upon fact, has been carried on not only against me, but against the cause I represent. They were centered upon the following unjustifiable accusations. One, Coughlin attacks Jews in the most un-American speech ever delivered. 2. Coughlin defends Nazism and the Nazi pogroms, which means mass murder.
When you hear that...
Right. It's eerie.
Yeah.
I don't know that he really ever defended things like the pogroms. I don't know. In his speeches, I don't remember that as appearing. He was, interestingly enough, and I think this is a parallel in each one of these groups, he gave cover to people who shared his same ideas but who couldn't dare be vocal about it. So people who were already anti-Semitic could say, well, I'm not a Coughlinite. Listen to him. And the same thing had happened with the Klan. They gave cover to people who were anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-Black. And so that's the really deadly part about these groups. They gave cover, and because they were so extreme, they made the centrists toward the right centrists look like normal people. They made them look like they were really okay. And it happens in every one of these time periods.
And here we go
again.
And
here we are.
And we should note, Father Coughlin was finally muzzled by church authorities.
He was. Yes. They took away his broadcast in 1941, right after Pearl Harbor was bombed. FBI trucks, Army trucks came up to the shrine and loaded up all kinds of materials and took it back to Washington. It's very difficult. I found it more difficult to research Coughlin and find anything new than these other groups, because a lot of his papers are buried someplace. And the Archdiocese, if they have them, they don't share.
Well, we also know that there have been groups such as the John Birch Society in Michigan, the Black Legion, and of course you began by talking about the Michigan Militia. A little about those groups, John Birch Society.
The John Birch Society comes right out of the Cold War era. Its biggest issue is fear of communism, defense of America. They were people who supported Barry Goldwater, extremism and defense of liberty is no vice in 64. And the Birch Society is never as big as the Klan by any means, or certainly not the Coughlin followers. But the Birch Society was more middle class and even some upper class people who were dedicated to getting together and studying and being almost in cells, like the communists that they so hated, so that they could give factual information and they would report on people as being dangerous. The Birch Society has endured. I mean, they are still out there, but their numbers aren't much greater. But what they did was they were like a phalanx inside the Republican Party. And they made a very strong stand as a minority within the Republican Party, which was sort of a cacophony of various interest groups. And so they were able to have a great deal of influence.
And the Black Legion.
And the Black Legion, I didn't cover them in this book because I was looking at groups that really are grassroots-based. The Black Legion is more like the present-day Klan in that they're a hate group who just like to kill people and damage them. And they were in Detroit, and they did commit some murders. They were white supremacists. They were a fearsome group, but a tiny group of thugs, really.
Terrorists.
Yeah.
Domestic terrorists.
They were.
And the Michigan Militia, that's more recent. We certainly saw a big burst in the 90s, but they're not gone.
They're not gone. The Michigan Militia is an umbrella name for various groups. They aren't unified. There is no real solid Michigan militia. They tried that, but they could never get the factions all together. So what it is local groups, local brigades breaking, apart and with local leaders. And they work together sometimes. They fought, but they also work together. And what their concern was to protect the country from within. They were afraid that our leaders had been duped. They emerged at the time of Ruby Ridge, Waco, Clinton was president. They hated Clinton. The Monica Lewinsky affair, they were appalled, even though some of them were divorced and admitted to having affairs. They said, well, not in the Oval Office. So they're emerging like the other groups in their time.
We're going to be ready to protect our own from the government.
That's exactly. They were afraid the government would march on them.
Now, you are eager to make a point that Michigan has been a fertile breeding ground for extremist thought on the left as well.
That's right. That's another book if I wanted to ever get to it, or somebody else should. Because at the same time we have these groups on the right, we've had a very strong group on the left, and it starts right here in Ann Arbor. And always, all along, Teddy Roosevelt won in Michigan with the progressive vote when he ran in 1912. He won Michigan. So there have been progressive movements and efforts all along across the 20th century, the union movement. And some within the union movement are really at the far left end. The IWW had its headquarters in Detroit in the early part of the 20th century. You know, right on up through all of these years, there have been corresponding left-wing groups.
Would you say today, as we talk in 2017, looking at this history leading up to now, where would you put Michigan, Joellen, in terms of extremist or hate group activity? I know it's so much of it is underground.
Right. Right now, the Southern Poverty Law Center says Michigan has 28 hate groups that they have charted, which is a lot compared to others. Ohio has more, but Ohio is a bigger state. Wisconsin has fewer. So Michigan, throughout its history, really, from its founding, it's at the forefront of changes and developments that are happening nationwide. It's often a leader or very involved at the beginning. I mean, if you think back, we had the copper and iron ore industrialized companies and factories well before many other places. Then we've got the auto industry. And so we're always at the forefront. We go into the Rust Belt early on, too.
So our economy has great highs and great lows. Does that make us more susceptible?
It makes people very fearful. You know, you can get rich, but you can lose it all too here. You can find the American dream or it will be dust at your feet.
And then when that happens, you go looking for someone to blame.
You do. You have to find somebody to blame. And the trouble is with all these groups, you know, they come and go, but they leave an impression or a legacy within the community, because they really got a lot of these ideas from within the community anyhow, but they leave a lasting legacy that then gets codified. It gets built into law. In the 20s, we get immigration quotas. In the 30s, we get Roosevelt's programs. We get anti-communism at its peak here in the 60s and 70s. And so all along, these people are at the forefront of nationwide movements. And although they're small and they seem like kooks to some others, but they have a big lasting impact. And that's what's so frightening.
Well, our thanks so much to Eastern Michigan University history professor Joellen Vineyard for talking with us. Her book is Right in Michigan's Grassroots, From the KKK to the Michigan Militia. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Jacob Meschke. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.